healthcare, that dominate whether we have jobs or not. Why should these parasites in society have access to all of the wealth where all the income inequality that Bernie Sanders rightfully talks about is being driven based on the domination of the banks? What do the banks actually contribute? 150 years ago in capitalism, they were an entity that gave you a loan when you needed some credit. Now they dominate all parts of society. Should society be of, by, and for the bankers? Well, Bernie Sanders would say no, and we would say no too, but he doesn't say the hard thing that has to be said, which is the banks have to be seized. In order to seize the banks, you need a political revolution, a real revolution, because property forms have to change. When we look at property, does property give up its property? Does it give up its privilege without a fight? Did the slave-owning ruling class, which was the dominant part of the U.S. capitalist class, give up its slaves? Even the slave owners who might have been more liberal, you know, maybe didn't whip their slave as much, maybe had a more humane attitude, maybe they were good Christians, but they weren't going to get rid of this institution of slavery because that was the basis of their profit. It had to be broken up through a revolutionary process, also known as a U.S. Civil War, which we celebrate formally. The expropriation of that class property was necessary. That's why we say we are revolutionary socialists. Bernie Sanders says, I'm a democratic socialist. Well, revolutionary socialists are democratic too, but what he's signaling is we're not really for the revolutionary seizure of the capitalist property. The reason so many people are poor in America, and one out of every two people in the United States are either in poverty or near poverty, in spite of the fact that they work hard, they take care of their kids, they want the best for themselves and their children, the reason they're poor is the banks have all the money. It's pretty much as simple as that. But you can't just redistribute wealth. You have to seize the wealth in order for it to be redistributed. Why should the chairman of J.P. Morgan just give himself a raise so that he's making $300 million next year? That's a million a day almost. What did he do? He made deals to shut down somebody's factory, send it to Mexico, send it to Thailand. I mean, the banks, from our point of view, are a criminal enterprise.
So then what, from your point of view, is to be done? I mean, because as we were talking off air a moment ago, there is at least consideration strategically, tactically, given broader concerns or obstacles to where you all, or where you would call for some support of Bernie versus someone else, and I was thinking of it this way. I'm finding it interesting that when Obama was pushing his Affordable Health Care Act, those of us on his left who were saying we want full, free, national, socialized medicine, national health care, we were told, well, we have to go in incremental steps. This is a step in the right direction, at least. We can't expect that kind of revolutionary act to occur so quickly. Now, Obama himself, Hillary, other supporters of those two, even Bernie to an extent in his defense of that act by saying he helped write it, that they're now using its existence to work against Bernie's call for that socialized healthcare. In other words, the reform is now, that was told to us to be, would be a stepping stone to something better, is being used to blunt something better from actually occurring. I'm using that in my mind to draw this analogy to this whole point of why should we vote, or why should we support that party regardless of the situation, with this, resisting this notion that, well, it's a step in the right direction. At least it's, eventually then we'll get to something better. Do you understand where I'm going?
I certainly do. I mean, let's look at the healthcare. Bernie Sanders says Medicare for all. Obama and Clinton are attacking Bernie Sanders for being like a raging communist because he thinks people should be able to go to a doctor when they're sick. I mean, it actually doesn't take socialism to do that.
Right.
European capitalist countries have instituted that welfare program because they were, of course, competing with the Soviet Union, which was a close by neighbor, which gave people all those rights. So they said, yeah, let's give the workers these rights so they don't become communists. So, but in America, none of that exists. And so you have Obama. The irony of this situation is that Obama came in, adopted Mitt Romney's Republican economic program, healthcare program. Now, that's a program that privatizes all healthcare and puts it all under the hands of the biggest capitalist private insurance companies who do not provide health care. They just ration health care. And they are capitalists who are involved in health care, not to make people feel better, but to make a profit. Now, when he did that, the Republicans who fashioned the program called him a communist,
right,
which helped us because then people started looking up, well, what's socialism?
Right.
And it became the most looked up word in the Merriam-Webster dictionary because of all the red baiting of Obama. But here you have Sanders coming in and saying Medicare for all, meaning like when you're 65 or if you're a military veteran, you know, the government's going to make sure you can go to a doctor. That's what it is. And he's got a modest program for that. Now, what he's doing is actually expressing the will of the American people. And when President Obama came in March 2009, 77% of the people, according to a New York Times survey, said, we want single-payer health plan, which means Medicare for all. Not really socialized medicine, but something better than what we have. And Obama said, that's off the table. Why? He had the House of Representatives, he had the Senate, he had, it was a popular president, there was a euphoria around his, if there was ever a time for a single-payer health plan, that was the moment. He said, it's off the table, which shows what? It shows the liberals are really just like always doing the dirty work for the right wing, because they don't, they think, well, if we steal the thunder of the right wing, then the right wing won't attack us, won't trash us. And the right wing thinks, no, they didn't say to Obama, hey, thank you very much, let's be friends. They just kept up the assault against people's rights. Also, we have Trump, we have the right-wing candidates, we have even Obama and Clinton representing neoliberal policies. What does Sanders really represent? A return to Democratic Party liberalism, which the Clinton family crushed during the 1990s, again, because they were listening to the bankers, not to the people. The bankers wanted to get rid of welfare as we know it. So Clinton says, well, we're going to end welfare as we know it in 1996. Who did that hurt? 7 million children in a one fell swoop. Poor kids, right, taken away from having any sort of economic support. Or the fact that he had NAFTA, which gave millions of jobs over to the biggest banks and corporations so that they could be exported. I mean, it was they who banished the liberal word. Like they say, oh, Sanders is a socialist. You can never be elected as a socialist. In the 1990s, Clinton said, that's the L word. They thought you can't be elected as a liberal. So every step of the way, the people you're talking about who are attacking Sanders, the liberals, are actually the ones who have paved the way for the ascendancy of the right. The right is bold, audacious. The liberals are just capitulators, ascendant to the right wing. Sanders says he's a democratic socialist, but his program is actually old-style liberalism, which in the 21st century becomes extreme communism from the point of view of the bank's propaganda against it. They don't want to give the people anything.
Well, there at least was a conversation hosted here recently with sort of a mini town hall with Sanders supporters, many of whom said that if he doesn't get the nomination, they will not support Hillary or the Democratic Party.
They should support Gloria LaRiva and Eugene Perrier, because that's the thing. At the end of the day, we're very sympathetic to the movement that has developed around Sanders' campaign. We don't have a sectarian attitude about it. The fact that 68% of the caucus goers in Iowa say, I'm okay with a socialist president, that means something new in the United States, where anti-communism had been the unofficial religion of the country since the Cold War. That's a good thing. That means people can talk about socialism. So what Sanders is doing is good, but end of the day, he says he will support whoever the Democratic Party nominee is. Now, you take those hundreds of thousands, millions of people who are supporting Bernie Sanders. If he doesn't get the nomination, he says, join me and support Hillary Clinton. But he just fought Hillary Clinton because she represents the banks, which he's right about. So why should we, in the name of party loyalty or to stop the Republicans, then support Hillary Clinton and the banks who did all the damage to the people in the first place? I mean, that's the logic, the false logic of lesser evil politics. So I would say to the people in the Sanders campaign, if you want to be true to Sanders' principle or avowed principles, and he takes you into the Democratic Party after the convention in August, don't follow him. Join the PSL campaign, LaRiva and Perrier. You know what? We might not win, but when you vote for a lesser evil, it's still evil. And the whole idea of Sanders is to give hope that there can be something other than evil in terms of American politics.
So let me ask as a closing question you to respond to what is my new favorite Marx quote found in your book that I had not seen before reading this book, or at least didn't remember. The weapon of criticism cannot, of course, replace criticism by weapons. Material force must be overthrown by material force, but theory also becomes material force as soon as it has gripped the masses.
Yeah, I mean,
what does that mean?
Well, what that means, what Lenin means is that when the people become conscious, there is no power greater on the planet. And we can see that throughout history. You know, before things start, before movements start, they seem impossible. After they've started, they seem inevitable. We knew that was coming, but of course you didn't. You can take what happened in Montgomery in 1955 with Rosa Parks. She had been not giving up her seat lots of times, and people hadn't like started boycotts. This time they did. And once they came into motion, they started to feel their power. They started to lose their fear. They started to think about the possibilities, the hopefulness of a new world. That became the most powerful force, an impossible force to stop. Could not be stopped. And that's how all revolutions happen. It's like when the masses of people who seem apathetic, distracted, apolitical, suddenly become gripped with possibility. From Marxism, theory is not a dogma. Theory is the generalized experience of the people's struggle. And so you learn from the past. That's why we teach history. It's the generalization. Our rulers, the oppressors, don't want our young kids to know like what came before them so that each time they have to start over from scratch. But there's this rich history of struggle. So Marxism is really very basically not something for academics. It's something for the people. It's the theory of liberation, the theory that liberation is possible. It's not a utopia. It's not a dream. It doesn't have a blueprint for the future. But it says working folks can be in charge. Working folks can be in power. Poor people can run society. And that's what it means. In terms of the question of arms versus criticism, of course, we're always baited, are you violent? So we have to be careful when we answer questions. Whenever we go to a demonstration, the police say, is there going to be any violence? And we say, well, you're the ones with guns. Yeah, you're the ones with clubs. You're the ones with tear gas, mace. We didn't bring any weapons with us, but we're always the ones they ask about weapons. But of course, we do know, and Marxism does, in terms of its generalized theory, recognize that the old existing powers that be normally don't give up, and we don't even know of any instance in history where they've given up their power and privilege without them struggling against the people who want justice. And so when the people who want justice have violence imposed on them, do they have the right to defend themselves? So Marxism is always treated as the doctrine of violence. It really is the doctrine of self-defense by the collective mass against the oppressors who refuse to allow justice to take place and impose all kinds of violence against it. People do have a right to defend themselves.
Well, for no other reason, I want people to check out your book because my father was known as the Black Lenin. He looked, favored him, and because I used to hang out.
You look a little bit like Lenin.
Now I'm getting older, getting balder, favoring my father's
look. Beard.
So you get the beard and everything. But also because his image adorned State of the Union on U Street. So shout out to D.C.'s hip-hop community where I used to hang out.
And, very good. So,
Brian, thanks again for joining
us. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us here at the Real News Network. And I mix what I like. Again, I'm Jared Ball here in Baltimore saying, as always, as Fred Hampton used to say, to you we say peace if you're willing to fight for it. So peace, everybody, and we'll catch you in the whirlwind.
The people's flag is fever's red, it's shrouded off the mass of dead. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. One dollar head seemed dark as night. It witnessed many a deed and vow. We mustn't change its color now. Raise the scarlet standard high. Beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. It well recalls the triumphs past. It gives the hope of peace at last.
the banner bright, the symbol plain of human rights and human gain.
Flames the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll never die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
His mind's affixed on self and place, the cringe beneath the rich man's frown and all that sacred emblem down.
Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
With heads uncovered swear we all to bear it on board till we fall. Come dungeons dark or gallows grim, this song should be our parting hymn.
Raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and that was Billy Bragg with the Red Flag, and of course what we played before then was Brian Becker of the Party of Socialism and Liberation, talking to Jared Ball on the Real News Network there about Vladimir Lenin, about the Russian Revolution, about what it represented as an anti-colonial force in the world, as well as taking a stand against global capitalism. And really unpacking really what that means. And of course, we're going to continue doing that on Back in the USSR over the coming weeks as we talk about the Russian Revolution on the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution and getting into the various aspects of that and the history and the ongoing relevance today. Like I say, the show we did tonight, like it's focused on anti-colonialism and how the Soviet Union and the Russian Revolution really inspired so many anti-colonial struggles and assisted so many anti-colonial struggles, and of all these people fighting for self-determination all around the world, and the collapse of the Soviet Union was a terrible blow to those movements, whether that's in Palestine, whether that was in South Africa, Latin America, or different parts of Asia. I mean, like these kind of people, I mean, like now they were exposed as they were not before to the violence of the American superpower. And of course, we saw what happened in Iraq as a result of that. We saw what happened in Yugoslavia as a result of that, in Libya, in Syria, these places that didn't suffer that kind of intervention, that kind of imperialist invasion before, because the Soviet Union had them covered. Now they're vulnerable. They can be, you know, the U.S. wants to enact regime change. They can go in there and they can, like, just wreck the most unimaginable carnage. In order to make the world safe for the Fortune 500, which, of course, is what the United States government is all about. But like one of the things I talked about before was the impact that the Russian Revolution had on the struggle of African-Americans against segregation and against racism in America, and like how the impact that had on them. And one of the main figures in the civil rights movement who was really influenced by the Russian Revolution was W.E.B. Du Bois. I talked about him last year when I did a whole series of shows on Black History Month. But he's a huge figure in terms of like the development of the civil rights struggle, the struggle against Jim Crow and segregation in the United States. And he was a communist. And this next clip from the Real News Network, which I'm going to play, is actually all about W.E.B. Du Bois' relationship with the Soviet Union and with the Russian Revolution. So I'm going to get into that a little bit. Obviously, that could be a whole other show right there, talking about the impact that the Russian Revolution had on African Americans. But I'm going to start, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to play this this excerpt from the Real News Network on W.E.B. Du Bois and his relationship with the Soviet Union. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Thank you. Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul J. in Baltimore. We're continuing our discussion on the occasion of February 23rd, which is the 145th anniversary of the birth of W.E.B. Du Bois. And now joining us to continue this chat is Anthony Montero, who's a professor of African American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us again, Anthony.
Thank you, Paul.
Talk a bit about Du Bois's attitude, I guess, starting with the Russian Revolution, the American Communist Movement, trade unionism, and it's a whole arc of his life, right, till 93 years old.
There's a lot. Just in the 1920s, you know, he writes this essay, I think it's published in 1916, called The African Roots of the War. And he says that World War One is a war over which European power would dominate the colonies in Africa. He says Germany is the aggressor and the protagonist because in the Berlin Conference of 1885, Germany got the smallest amount of colonies. By the beginning of the 20th century, Germany is the fastest growing industrial nation and it wants more colonies. It therefore goes to war. He puts Africa at the center of this war.
It's very controversial, his position on the First World War, because if I understand correctly, in the beginning, he's advocating for more blacks to be in the army, which more or less supports the war. Then he takes a position criticizing the war. But then in 1918, apparently he's offered a commission and he decides to close. He writes this thing called Close Ranks, which winds up supporting the war, which was very controversial on the American left, right?
Yes, it was, and especially on the black left. You know, he supports Wilson, President Wilson's entering the war with the condition that one, it is a war against the aggressor, Germany, two, that the peace after the war would be a democratic peace, which would mean steps to decolonize Africa, a process begun under a newly written international legal system with the League of Nations. He felt betrayed after the war by Wilson and the other Allied powers who in Versailles sought to establish a peace without decolonization. He felt this was wrong. He felt it was a mistake because he felt that the source of the war were colonies and which nation would have the largest share of the African and Asian colonies. Well, of course he was right because if you think about World War II and you think again about Germany as the protagonist and now under the leadership of Hitler, the question of colonies is uppermost.
When he takes this position on World War One, it's at a time when, just before the Russian Revolution, and the communist movement and much of the left movement around the world is taking the position that workers of different countries should not slaughter each other and the workers instead should fight their own elites. And instead of taking that position, he winds up closing ranks, as you say, because he hopes it leads to decolonization.
He was wrong by not seeing the issue of workers slaughtering one another and this hyper-nationalism that comes about with war, but they did not see the colonial and race question. You see what I'm saying? So there were errors on both sides, and certainly in placing his confidence in Woodrow Wilson as an arbiter for anti-colonialism was a great mistake, and he admitted it.
So this then raises the question of his attitude towards the communist movement, because the communist movement and Lenin and these kinds of people, they are talking about the anti-colonial struggles. And it's part of the grand picture of how that movement saw the world. But I don't know, I'm not so sure what in terms of the American movement and how real that was in the American movement, especially in terms of how so much of the leadership of some of the unions, at least, were in fact quite racist. And then the Communist Party here, I mean, they certainly did advocate unions that were multiracial, but I don't know how that worked in practice. So what was his relationship? Because just quickly at the end, when he's like 93 years old, he joins the Communist Party.
Exactly. Well, you know, you had, after World War One, this upsurge of leftist activism. And you had leftists in the African-American community, Cyril Briggs, A. Philip Randolph, and others. And many of them supported the Russian Revolution. Du Bois hesitates. Claude McKay, the poet, is very outspoken in his support. But then Du Bois has an opportunity in 1926 to visit the Soviet Union. And he writes this famous article that appears in the Pittsburgh Courier, an African-American newspaper, where he says that if what I've seen is Bolshevism, then I am a Bolshevik. I think this is a very important moment. You know, the Russian Revolution changes the international equation, and for the first time, a great power in the modern era is supporting anti-colonialism. Du Bois becomes thereafter a supporter, in fact, a partisan of the Soviet Union.
What then was his relationship with the American Communist Party? Because while he supported the Soviet Union, he never joined the American Communist Party during this whole period. In fact, he didn't vote for their candidates and such.
No, he disagreed, especially in the 1930s, on several questions. One, he disagreed with the Communist Party's slogan of a Black Belt Republic. He felt that that to do that would be to separate the Black working class from the main thrust of class and race struggles in the United States.
What was this proposal, Black Belt Republic?
Well, you know, part of the Communist Party's conceptualization of the question of racial oppression was to conceptualize Black oppression as an instance of national oppression, very similar to the colonial question in Africa and Asia. And as such, in what was viewed as 165 counties stretching from Virginia down to Louisiana and Mississippi, there were 165 counties that had a Black majority. And the Communist Party said that it would be conceivable that as part of resolving the race question, which they again saw as a national question, that these 165 counties could become a Black Belt Republic with the right to self-determination.
And Du Bois opposed this because it sounds like separate but equal in a different way.
Well, that's what he thought. And so he disagrees also with the Communist Party on the conduct of the struggle to save the lives of the Scottsboro boys. You know, the nine young men who were accused of raping two white women. And this became an international cause célèbre in a lot of ways because of the leadership of the Communist Party. He felt that the Communist Party had brought its politics too much into the case, and they would be benefiting, they were seeking political benefit out of this.
Now, for the sake of argument, some people write the history that he didn't get involved in the early stages, and the Communist Party did, and so they wound up kind of reaping the rewards of the campaign, and that he resented them because it sounded like they were trying to take leadership away from his organization. I mean, I what do you make of that?
That's arguably true. He wanted the NAACP to get involved in it from the beginning. He wanted Black leadership to spearhead the movement. He felt this was part of a larger civil rights agenda. And so on. So there was that competition, and I think you're right about that.
All right. Well, as I said, this is just the beginning, and we're going to do many other segments about the life of Du Bois because I think it's a important life, a fascinating life, and a lot in terms of what's going on today. But let me just ask you one more question before we conclude for now. A lot of what I think shaped Du Bois's life was that, in theory, socialism was better for people. In theory, even the Communist Party and that movement made sense, and the class analysis made sense. But there was so much in practice, he wound up against white racism in those movements, that it was hard to actually go the whole way to see it in fulfillment. And then others did. I mean, people like Paul Robeson, and in fact, many of the people that built the trade unions and the communist movement were African Americans. But he still had this relationship. So a little bit about that, and then how does that look like today?
Yeah, it's so complicated. And you know, as you said, he's a very complicated individual. A lot of pride in black leadership and in his leadership. But then for him, the question was, how do you get from where we are to where we want to be? How do we carry out both the struggle for black civil rights, which is a broad democratic struggle, which also involves the rights of unions and the rights of women, and ultimately the struggle against war? How do we conduct that struggle in such a way that we move from where we were, that is the Jim Crow segregated, openly racist society, to a society of true equality and true and real redistribution of wealth, which would not only mean formal equality, but equality in substance? And that was what he struggled with, really, from 1920 to the end of his life. And he wanted a theory and a practice to do that. And I don't think anyone ever thought more deeply about the complexities of this transition than he did.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us, Anthony.
Thank you so much, Paul.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
The devil's devil has a couple fools. My culture's screwed, cause this word is misconstrued. Small countries exempt from food, cause leaders have different views. You choose.
What mean the world to me is being free. Live and let live and just let it be.
Let it be.
Love, peace, and harmony. One universal family. One God, one aim, and one destiny.
Oh yeah. Imagine life without a choice at all. Giving a vote without a voice at all. These be the problems that we face. I'm talking poverty and race, but no matter what the case, we gotta
hold on to this feeling. Freedom, freedom. That hold on to this feeling. Freedom, freedom.
Yo, I'm the first candidate to hate. Had to beat on the drum to communicate. For what was to come to those who were hung, they would decapitate the tongue if you would mention the word freedom.
Got people screaming free Bonilla Jamal, but two out of three of y'all will probably be at the mall. I'm heated with y'all, the defeated will fall, incomplete and unsolved when the word freedom's involved.
Yo, my forefathers hung in trees to be free.
Rest in peace.
Got rid of slavery but still kept the penitentiary. And now freedom got a shotgun and shells with your name. Release the hot ones and let freedom ring.
I'm a former boat prisoner, Hollywood visitor. Dance for cats segregated on wax. My color got me handy. Cap, Anus, and Andy. For the freedom they just won't hand me.
Hold on to this feeling.
cause it's not a lot of time. Your heart, body, soul, and your mind. It's so true and they've been hurting so long. That's the reason why we named this song. Cause it's not a lot of time. Your heart, body, soul, and your mind. It's so true and they've been hurting so long. That's the reason why we named this song.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, was Jurassic 5 with Freedom and the Real News Network, the clip we heard before. That was W.E.B. Du Bois and the Soviet Union. And like you can see, like, even if he did not agree with, say, like every policy that the Communist Party USA had, I mean, he still was a communist. He was convinced that socialism was the way forward for African Americans. And, you know, he saw the work that socialists were doing in fighting against segregation and Jim Crow, and which no one else was doing at the time. So, I mean, that was absolutely huge. And W.E.B. Du Bois, of course, one of the fathers, really, of the civil rights movement in the first half of the 20th century. You know, he is a very significant figure. And once again, he is a communist, and he is was very much part of the anti-colonial struggle around the world, very much an internationalist. Went to the Soviet Union, went to China after the revolution, like went to all these places and expressed solidarity, worked with people, organized. He wasn't just active in the United States by any means. Like, he very much was involved in the international anti-colonial movement. It was really blossoming with really a leadership role played by the Soviet Union, as I've been talking about throughout this show. But the last word I really want to give to him, so I want to play an excerpt from his speeches, actually. This is W.E.B. Du Bois in a speech which he gave when he was a very old man, like in his 90s, in the early 1960s, when he was still politically active. It's entitled Socialism in the American Negro. And this is really talking about his views upon what socialism really needs to do to address the issues of African Americans, what they face. And so I'm going to end on that. I'm going to close the show on that. And of course, we're going to talk further in subsequent episodes of the show about the Russian Revolution and other aspects of it, because it's very important to understand. And once again, this is marking the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. So stay tuned for more of that. But I'm going to close off the show with W.E.B. Du Bois, Socialism in the American Negro. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Ladies and gentlemen, socialism and the American Negro. Democracy has so disappeared in the United States that there are some subjects that cannot even be discussed. The essence of the democratic process is free discussion. There was a time when men were not allowed to talk about universal suffrage, or the education of women, or freedom for Negro slaves. Today, communism is the dirty word, and socialism is suspect. I often refer to my education in democracy. In the little New England town where I was born, we had a high school of about 25 pupils. I entered it in 1880 at the age of 12. As I attended the town meeting annually in the spring, there used regularly to appear one of the dirtiest old men I ever saw. He was fat and greasy, and every year he made a fierce attack on wasting his taxes on a high school. I was always furious. I wondered why the citizens sat silent and let him rant. But they did, and then quietly they voted the money for the high school. There I learned my lesson in democracy. Listen to the other side. In this state, and in our time, occurred one of the worst blows to the democratic process which our nation has suffered. Senator McCarthy succeeded in making America afraid to discuss socialism or to recognize communism as aught but a conspiracy. And this in the state of Robert La Follette. I knew La Follette and his valiant wife. I voted for him for president in 1924. And I saw him give his life fighting monopolized wealth and asking world peace. My own work at the time was trying to secure freedom and equality for American Negroes. For a quarter of a century, I edited a little monthly magazine, The Crisis. And despite opposition, I spoke plainly. I was criticized as being bitter, as seeking not simply political but social equality for Negroes, for favoring the teachings of Karl Marx, and for joining the Socialist Party. These accusations were true. But largely as a result of my work and the work of others, the Negro made progress toward equal citizenship. Progress, but not complete success. The collapse of the capitalist system after the First World War brought poverty, unemployment, and distress worse than America had ever seen. And then came a surge toward socialism called the New Deal. The nation relieved distress, built public works, helped agricultural trade, encouraged literature and art. It joined the Soviet Union in overthrowing Hitler, Mussolini, and Japan, and informing the United Nations to avoid future war. With the death of Roosevelt came reaction. The United States not only stopped progress toward socialism, but ceased to discuss or study it, and came to regard the object of socialism and communism as a crime. Especially American Negroes, still as a mass, poor and ignorant and sick, were given no opportunity to know the sort of progress the world was making to ameliorate the plight of the unfortunate working people the world over, who were in conditions similar to ours. American Negroes were not socialists. They did not know what communism was doing or trying to do, but they knew that Negro education must be better, that Negroes must have better opportunity to work and to receive a wage which would let them enjoy a decent standard of life. They were victims of disease and drifting into crime. To remedy this, they sought to pattern their life after successful Americans. They must work hard, save money, become employers and property owners and investors. This, they thought, would bring them recognition as American citizens equal to others. But America had changed. There was still a chance for some to rise and get rich, but the working classes were no longer generally able to buy land. Their wages did not amount to what they in reality earned, and those handicapped by race prejudice had small chance to overcome poverty and ignorance and disease. A class structure began to arise within the Negro group, which produced haves and have-nots, and tended to encourage more successful Negroes to join the forces of monopoly and exploitation and help victimize their own classes and any other lower classes that were possible. To remedy this situation, thinking Negroes still regarded their first step toward emancipation as being political power. They felt that their present plight was due to the fact that they had never become voting citizens of the country, and their first efforts were toward gaining the real right to vote. The young colored men of 1905, of which I was one, emphasized this. This group meeting at Niagara Falls, Canada, in June 1905, demanded freedom of speech and criticism, manhood suffrage, the abolition of all distinctions based on race, recognition of basic principles of human brotherhood, and respect for the working man. They called themselves the Niagara Movement. And despite violent attack on all sides, met again the next year, 1906, at Harper's Ferry. There they said, "In the past year, the work of the Negro hater has flourished in the land. step by step, the defenders of rights of American citizens have retreated. The work of stealing the black man's ballot has progressed, and 50 or more representatives of stolen votes still sit in the nation's capital. Never before in the modern age has a great and civilized folk threatened to adopt so cowardly a creed in the treatment of fellow citizens born and bred on its soil. Stripped of verbose subterfuge and in its naked nastiness, the new American creed says, fear to let black men even try to rise, lest they become the equals of whites. This in the land that professes to follow Jesus Christ. The blasphemy of such a course was only matched by its cowardice. This was the statement of 1906. The NAACP, organized in 1909, added to the program of the Niagara Movement the realization that the fight for Negro freedom could not be carried on by Negroes alone, but by a national movement which united Negroes and whites. They emphasized the role which prejudice played, a prejudice often unconscious but nevertheless effective. The NAACP made a nationwide fight against the horror of lynching and mob violence, and then more and more began to concentrate on the legal aspects of race discrimination and the fact that the Negro was oppressed because the Constitution of the United States was not being enforced. This fight had unprecedented success and culminated in 1954 in the unanimous decision of the Supreme Court against segregation. But during all this struggle, we knew that something still was lacking. If we harked back to the cry of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and brotherhood, it was clear that there was not and could not be liberty of individual action under the great industrial organization which was growing up in the world led by the United States. Production and industry and trade involved planning, and planning curtailed liberty. Moreover, our inequality as Negroes was a matter of fact. Negroes, with their ignorance and poverty and sickness, were distinctly below the average of those of their white neighbors who were educated and well-to-do and healthy. Finally, despite all propaganda, we saw democracy failing in America. Fewer and fewer people went to the polls. It was increasingly difficult to know for whom or for what one was voting, and the cost of elections arose to suspicious heights. The election in which Abraham Lincoln became President of the United States cost about $100,000. The election which made Dwight Eisenhower president probably cost more than $100 million. It's possible that it cost twice that. Election expenses today include not only direct bribery, but indirect influences, monopoly, propaganda, and deception. Under these circumstances, the appeal of socialism to all Americans increased. But the answer to the doctrines of Karl Marx and the utopias of Fourier and others was that with human nature as it is, socialism simply would not work. To me, the obvious approach to socialism seemed consumers' cooperation. I tried to plan an organization among Negroes as consumers which would furnish employment, help savings, and bring unity of action. But it was soon evident, as many of my fellow workers warned me from the beginning, that individual action alone could not bring consumers' cooperation, that without the power of the government it would fail, and with government cooperation it was socialism. My own training in this thought came from my travel. My 2 years sojourned in Germany at the end of the 19th century, where I saw the rise of the Social Democratic Party. My repeated visits to England and France in the first decade of this century. My visits to the Soviet Union in 1926, 1936, and 1949. Then, as a peculiar aftermath of the two world wars and my advocacy of peace, my travel abroad was stopped from 1950 to 1958. In 1958, I was able to make a trip covering 11 months in which I visited Western Europe, Eastern Europe, including the Soviet Union, and the Republic of China. This trip completely transformed my thinking. I started on it believing that socialism was a possible form of government and economic organization and was being carried on successfully in Eastern Europe. That capitalism was also a successful form of organization, and while it might degenerate into fascism and the rule of wealth, nevertheless, it could, as had been proven by Franklin Roosevelt, become a progressive organization. I returned with completely changed ideas. I saw socialism as the most successful form of government today possible in the Soviet Union and in the Chinese Republic. I saw it evolving into communism to an astonishing successful degree. On the other hand, I was frightened, and I am still alarmed at the degeneracy of capitalism and the possibility of it becoming a force so destructive that it cannot be endured. One of my first experiences was in England. I had in London a severe attack of intestinal disorder. A young physician summoned at midnight came and treated me. He made six or more visits within the next few days until he had me completely on my feet. When I asked for my bill, I was told that there was no charge, that his services were paid for by the British government. I reminded him that I was an American, and that in America we were repeatedly informed that socialized medicine in Great Britain was a failure. He smiled. The only cost of my illness was the medicine which he prescribed, and that was less than $5. On the other hand, I found that Great Britain, France, and Holland, and Belgium were countries which for past centuries had built their comfort, their prosperity, and civilization mainly on the free land and materials and cheap labor, partly furnished by their own working class, but mainly by colored people overseas whom they dominated by their colonial empires. In 1858, it was clear that the end of this colonialism was in sight. Already, most of the colonies of Holland had become independent, Britain had lost the Empire of India, and France was fighting in vain to hold North Africa. Yet despite the fact that the colonial organization must end, these three great countries of Western Europe, and others like Italy, West Germany, and Portugal, were depending for their future life on materials which they underpriced in the world market, on stolen land, and on labor wretchedly underpaid. The political power to carry on this process depended upon the laboring class in Western Europe and America, and that laboring class was being bribed by political power and high wage, which came not so much out of the profits of the employers as out of the low wages of colored labor. I did not sense in Western Europe, and certainly I had not seen in America, any disposition so to improve the organization of work and the distribution of income as to make any essential change in the present capitalist system. On the other hand, I was astonished and encouraged by what I saw socialism doing. Not only did I see the results of socialized medicine in England, and progress in housing, health, and workers' pensions in Sweden, Holland, Belgium, and France, but in the Soviet Union and East Germany, I saw a change of attitude toward the masses of people, not as the wards and beneficiaries of the rulers of the nation, but as the main body which itself owned the nation and for which the nation existed, and as the reservoir out of which were being recruited those people who were making civilization. In China, it seemed to me that the process was going even further, and that human nature was being so changed that instead of self-seeking and class hatred, which so characterized the West, that there was coming a sense of partnership in a vast and growing nation, of willing cooperation and of a widespread content and happiness which I had not seen elsewhere in the world. All this was my deep and firm impression. I cannot prove it, particularly not to you who have been poisoned by lies and distortions for 10 years. After all, I saw these countries only partially and for brief visits, yet I am a traveler of some experience, and I know personally the trials of the poor and despised. I was given unusual opportunity for observation, and thus my conclusions are of some value. I saw the spread of socialism and communism. Today, more than half the people of the world live under a socialism which is growing toward communism. In my mind, there is no doubt but that the world of the 21st century will be overwhelmingly communistic. Returning now to the United States, I look again upon the scene. The legal fight led by the NAACP has been an astonishing success. But its very success shows the limitations of law and law enforcement unless this program has an economic foundation. Unless the mass of Negro people have not simply legal rights, but have such rights to work and wage that enable them to live decently. Here in the United States, we have had a stirring of the Negro population which emphasizes these facts. In the slave South, Negroes impoverished and mistreated have sought remedy by pouring into the cities of the South and especially into the great cities of the North. They have caused problems of housing and of crime, of poverty and disease. It spells the damnation of youth and death of children and degradation of women. Through this, the American Negro is passing. It emphasizes our national problem of gambling and prostitution, drug using and murder and suicide. On the other hand, the Negroes who have grown in intelligence and awareness of their handicaps have begun to fight back by the use of the boycott and the passive resistance. The experience in Montgomery, the extraordinary uprising of the students all over the South and beginning in the North, shows an awareness of our situation which is most encouraging. But it still does not reach the center of the problem. And that center is not simply the right of Americans to spend their money as they wish and according to law, but the chance for American Negroes to have money to spend because of employment by which they can make a decent wage. What then is the next step? It is for American Negroes in increasing numbers and more widely to insist upon the legal rights which are already theirs, and then to add to that increasingly a socialistic form of government, an insistence upon the welfare state which denies the further carrying out of industry for the profit of those corporations which monopolize wealth and power. The stopping of a government of wealth, for wealth, and for wealth, and the returning of governmental power to the individual voter with all the freedom of action that can be preserved, along with an industry carefully organized for the good of the masses of people and not for the manufacture of millionaires. Does capitalism offer such a program? It does not. It offers war. We have gone insane with the idea that the world is going to be ruled by physical force. More than any other nation on earth or in time, we are spending fantastic sums of money to prepare for war and basing this necessity of war preparation on dislike and distrust and contempt for most of the human beings who inhabit the world. We have no peace movement in the United States that deserves the name. We have almost no men of intelligence and prestige who dare speak up for peace.
cold and silent.